2012, January 30th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 18, The Origin of Life on Earth. Well, we're still in the section where we're talking about life on Earth. And last week was a lot more like a biology class than an astronomy class because we needed to lay down the basis for what life is, what its requirements are, what kind of environments it lives in, its chemistry, and its chemical requirements. Now we want to turn back to the question of life on Earth in detail and look at the subject of where did life or how did life arise on the Earth? An unanswered question that I'll give basically a progress report upon. And then the next couple of lectures we'll look at the history of life on Earth. What were the first living things on Earth? What is the history of life from the first emergence of life in the fossil record to the present day? And finally, on Thursday, say something about extinctions, about sort of the dramatic end of life that has occurred at multiple times throughout the Earth's history, that is one of the important features of the history of life on Earth and has some important lessons that we're going to carry forward when we consider the problem of life elsewhere in the universe. But today I want to pick up the question of what our current ideas are, or where life started. How did life start on the Earth? This is going to turn into a couple of different questions and then some answers, or at least some attempts at answers that people are trying to work at this problem. One of the real sort of operational questions is, how did we start with the raw materials? How did we get the raw materials of life? And we know those raw materials are especially the amino acids, the functional pieces of cells or proteins. Proteins are chains of amino acids. So where do those amino acids come from? Because they don't just pop out of the Big Bang. They've got to come from somewhere. And so we'll look at some studies that have been done on how you can start from raw organic materials and get to the amino acids that we use today. We're then going to talk about two different models, two different attempts to figure out how you go from non-life to life. The first of these is something called RNA world, which is a model that proposes that it was reproduction via RNA, which was the first thing that emerged on Earth that actually was a plausible proto-life. The other takes a different tack, one of the other aspects of life, that it has a metabolism, energy utilization. And so there's a proposal, a different competing model called the metabolism-first model that proposes, in fact, what you had to have first happen was the establishment of these so-called catalytic networks for processing energy. Once you had those, you had the energy source that could then power reproduction. So it's not quite a chicken or egg problem. It's really which of the major components of a cell, its reproductive machinery or its metabolic machinery, came first in proto-life. And we'll look in some detail at that. Again, these are ideas that people are working with. We don't really know the actual answer yet, although we've made quite a bit of progress on ruling certain things out. Finally, at the very end, I'm going to talk about two other possibilities for origin of life called exogenesis or panspermia. Both of these are two different ways of saying that life did not actually originally arise on the Earth, but in fact it arose somewhere else and migrated to the Earth. It came from outside. That I only put that on the last slide of the last lecture kind of tells you right away what I think about those ideas, but I do need to mention them because they do still get some serious inquiry, although there's some good reasons for thinking this is not very smart. So today we're going to look at the origins of life on Earth. Now what we expect when we look at the first forms of life on the Earth, what we expect is it's not going to be as complex as even present-day bacteria are. We often speak of bacteria as being the simplest forms of life on Earth today. But in fact, if you look at inside of a typical bacterium, like an E. coli bacterium, for example, they're actually phenomenally complex. They have DNA, which encodes for heredity and cell function. They get energy through this catalytic adenosine triphosphate mechanism that powers all of the cell's machinery. In fact, it powers the machinery of all the cells that we know of in all living forms. Proteins are synthesized. That whole synthesis process is mediated through the use of RNA. We also see that RNA is what reads the instructions of DNA and leads to cell function. We see that a lot of the cell chemistry is enzyme catalyzed. It's actually quite some very remarkably complex biochemical chains are going on within cells to give them their function. And furthermore, if we look at the actual structure of the cell itself, we see this sort of bag made up of lipids, fat cells. But often this is not simply a simple bag, but in fact has numerous structures studying through this structure made up of various, mostly functional proteins. These structures can give them function. They might be sensory pieces. They might be a piece, like a flagellum, that actually gives the cell motility, ability to move through its medium. So even the simple bacterium is actually quite complex. It's got an awful lot going on. And we have to remember, although we refer to these as simple forms of life, although they are probably more closely related to the first forms of life on Earth than more complex creatures like ourselves, we still have to remember that the bacteria we see today are the products of 3.5 billion years of evolution. They are not, did not pop out of non-life looking like this. This is a very long procedure driven through natural selection, through the process of evolution. So we expect that the first forms of life are going to be a lot simpler when they appear on the Earth. The problem is, how do we get from the original raw materials out of which the Earth formed to the emergence of the very first forms of life on this planet? That question has a name. It's called abiogenesis. How do we get from non-life to life? What is the process by which chemical systems began to emerge, which were replicating and had that were self-replicating and had an energy-utilizing metabolism? Once you have a system that is capable of reproducing, capable of passing heredity down to offspring, you immediately make it subject to the rules of natural selection that then drive forward the evolution of this. This is an interesting reminder about something that's often a serious misconception about evolution. Evolution says nothing about the origin of life. It is about the origin of life's diversity. That's why Darwin titled his book The Origin of Species, not The Origin of Life. But evolution doesn't tell us a thing about how life got started. But once you start life, natural selection, evolution through natural selection, is the way in which you go from simple forms and you blast a forward through time to the biodiversity that we see. But let's back up a second and say, what is the problem of how we get from non-life to life? The basic requirements we know is that we need raw materials. You have to build it out of something. We know that liquid water seems to be essential to life. Carbon dioxide, certainly bioavailable carbon dioxide, either in the atmosphere or dissolved in water, is the primary source of carbon dioxide used by most forms of life on Earth, those that are autotrophs. We know that we need organic compounds. We need proteins, carbon compounds, things like that. And we know that we need phosphates. We need to have phosphorus in various forms, usually bonded with oxygen, because we know that phosphates play a number of really critical roles in life. Phosphate groups, in fact, are part of the energy source of life in the ATP cycle. Phosphates combined with sugars, ribose sugars and deoxyribose sugars, form the backbone of the structure of DNA. So phosphorus is extremely important. No phosphorus, no life as we recognize it on this planet. You need an energy source. There are two primary energy sources that we have seen being used by life: photosynthesis and chemosynthesis, the use of sunlight to power chemistry, or the use of inorganic oxidation, chemosynthesis, to power life. We know that we have to take the raw materials, the organic compounds, the energy utilization cycles, and we've got to put them in a bag. We've got to put a boundary that basically separates the organism and its functional parts from the surrounding environment. But that boundary also has to be permeable. It has to be able to let nutrients and raw materials in. It has to be able to let waste products out. So all life needs a boundary. We need to have a way to utilize either the sunlight or the inorganic energy sources, inorganic oxidation sources we have. We have to have a metabolism, a way of generating that energy that then makes that energy available to the rest of the cell's biochemistry to be able to function. We need a metabolism. Finally, we need to have the ability to make a copy of itself and to be able to pass that information down through the process of heredity. It isn't enough that it makes a copy. It has to be a fair copy that carries the information, the instructions. We now know in life, all life on Earth today, coded through the DNA, through the language of ATGC, to be able to build the cell, set up its function, and set it in motion. This is an awful lot of challenges, and not surprisingly, the question of how we went from the raw materials of the post-Hadean Earth to the first emergence of living things is still an unknown answer. I cannot give you a complete, coherent story as to how life arose on the Earth. But I can show you the outlines of what we've come to understand over the past few decades. And we do know from the evidence in the fossil record that once the Earth settled down at the end of the Hadean Aeon, and we're going to see this in subsequent lectures, life arose very, very rapidly. Once it got started, it moved really quick, almost a geological eye blink. One of the the questions is, how do you get amino acids? How do you actually build up what we know are the fundamental chemical building blocks of all forms of life? Proteins are chains of amino acids. All life uses one of 20 or 22 left-handed amino acids found in the earth, does not use any of the right-handed forms. But the question is, how do you build up the amino acids out of the raw materials that the earth was made of? There was a series of interesting experiments that occurred by two gentlemen named Miller and Urey in 1952 that attempted to show how amino acids could be made without biological processes. It could be made abiogenically. What they did was they said that the Earth's original atmosphere was a mixture of water vapor, methane, ammonia, molecular hydrogen, and carbon monoxide. Not carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, interestingly. And they used this as a simulacrum, as the chemical mix of the primordial Earth's atmosphere, the first atmosphere. They then said, well, I need to have a way to punch some energy into this. And an obvious way is in the weather, there is lightning. And so they set up basically a lightning chamber inside of a glass vessel that contained these gases in gas form, this primitive atmosphere model. They then zapped it with electricity, and then that electricity would then catalyze reactions. You've got chemical reactions that require energy to make more complex compounds. And then you precipitate it out, using basically by precipitating the water vapor as a carrier out through the system, trapped it, and then began to build up sort of a soup, which was heated up. For example, they had sort of a pseudo-ocean down here, and then an opening that they could reach through and actually sample out and see what chemicals emerged. So if you did nothing to this, then all you would get is water with dissolved gases. But when they precipitated this water out, they made the water vapor atmosphere rain in their sort of little experimental apparatus. They built up very quickly a kind of a murky soup. They kind of jokingly referred to it as primordial soup, which contained very simple amino acids and tars. Tars are basically carbon compounds, hydrocarbon compounds that form very readily. For example, they're kind of just carbon-carrying gunk. So that was part of what gave it the brown color. But when they did the chemical assay, what they found was amino acids. So simply punching energy where you have hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, the four basic pieces you needed for life, and the four basic components of most, not all, of the amino acids. You've got to have sulfur first for a couple of them. They were able to produce amino acids. The devil, however, is in the details. This is the original Miller-Urey apparatus. This is these little doodads here on the outside in black are part of their lightning machine. And this is the atmosphere chamber, the condenser, and this is their ocean chamber down below. So the So they zapped the atmosphere, their primordial atmosphere, with electricity, condensed out, made it rain, and formed their little sort of ocean. They had a little heater on top of it, and then they had a little sampling point they could pick it out. Well, first of all, there are a lot of objections that were immediately raised to the original Miller and Urey experiment. It was really interesting, the fact that you could go from really raw materials to amino acids only by zapping it with a little bit of lightning was quite eye-opening. A couple problems, however, is that the Earth's original atmosphere probably did not contain significant amounts of methane and ammonia. In fact, they're not common in primordial atmospheres. They don't come out of volcanoes. So why they plugged it in was kind of a misconception as to the atmosphere mix. Second of all, if you use carbon dioxide and nitrogen too, components that you do expect in the primordial atmosphere, you end up getting nitrates. And nitrates have a bad habit of attacking amino acids and breaking them down. It's one of the reasons why nitrates are kind of a bad thing. They're used as preservatives, for example. It's one of the things they do is they break proteins down. The other problem is that they got a whole bunch of organic goo. They got some hydrocarbon tar, some tholin, some other nasty things, but they only got 5 amino acids. There's 20 amino acids responsible for life, and they only got 5 of them. And they weren't terribly interesting because they made roughly equal proportions of left and right-handed amino acids. But we know from studies of life on the Earth that it's left-handed amino acids that mattered. So while you can get amino acids, you didn't get a whole bunch. So it was one of those experiments that was kind of interesting. It had some of the basic things right, but it was kind of missing some things. What's interesting about the Miller-Urey apparatus, as it's called over here, and the Miller-Urey experiment, is this is the one everyone paid attention to for years. It was the part that was published. Many years later, back in the laboratory of Miller, some of the people after Miller had died had gone back in and looked at his laboratory books and seen that, in fact, a second series of experiments had been run, but never published for reasons that no one understands. Maybe just didn't get around to it, maybe, you know, decided the first experiment was fine. The second analysis, instead of using that bogus, semi-bogus primordial atmosphere, they used a mixture of gases seen coming out of normal volcanoes. So, for example, you had water vapor in volcanoes, carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, a big difference here, carbon monoxide, nitrogen, N2, the common mix that you get out of normal volcanoes today. Did the experiment, got the organic goo in the container, and never really analyzed it, never actually took the stuff apart and bioassayed it. So a couple of the people in the laboratory, he kept all the original notebooks and all the original samples. So they analyzed the samples, and they found 22 amino acids and other organics. So the first experiment was a pathfinder, and it was interesting, but it had problems. The second set of experiments actually was far more compelling. You got a much higher diversity of amino acids. Now, you still had a mix of right and left-handed, but much greater amino acid diversity. They weren't broken down as badly as had been expected in the presence of nitrates. And in fact, if you think about it, volcano gases are actually the ones you want to be using, because that's probably what the early conditions on Earth really were like. The first atmosphere was built up not by gathering gases from the solar neighborhood, but by the gases welling up out of volcanoes in the primordial Earth. In fact, that's how our atmosphere has components set back into it as well. The other reason is that if you've ever seen a really heavy volcanic eruption, I've never witnessed one, but I've certainly seen pictures, like in 2008, this eruption of the Chaitén volcano down in southern Chile, is these volcanic plumes are often riddled with lightning. They're really lit up. They're very spectacular to look at. So you have raw materials and lots of lightning. So in many ways, the second set of experiments was really much better replicating things we actually see happen in nature. And in fact, what you see buried inside of volcanic eruptions are all the carbon dioxide, water vapor, nitrogen, hydrogen sulfide, and so forth. But you also find, people have claimed, freshly made amino acids. Now, the problem, of course, of doing that experiment today is there's an awful lot of amino acids in the environment due to all the plant life you're blasting up from around the volcano. So it's hard to make the separation. But people have now reproduced this experiment in the laboratory using mixes of gases from volcanoes and are actually finding a great number of amino acids. So this idea that amino acids can be made fairly readily by non-biological processes on the early Earth is actually straightforward. The raw materials are there in volcanic outgassing. The energy source is there in electrical discharges, aka lightning. But that's not the only evidence of the presence of amino acids. Amino acids turn out to be actually relatively easily made. The second line of evidence for the source of amino acids through non-biological means is that we found very complex organic molecules and amino acids in some carbon-rich meteorites. There's a particular class of meteorites. They're called carbonaceous chondrites. They're carbon-rich meteors. They come from the intermediate regions in the main belt of the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. This is a region that when the planets were condensing out of the original solar nebula are going to be rich in carbon because it's cold enough for carbon compounds to condense out. When you get into the zone where the Earth and Venus and Mercury were built, it's too hot for carbon to condense out of the gas phase, and carbon stays pretty much as a gas. That's why you've got to get it as being delivered to the Earth through these carbonaceous meteorites. One of these carbonaceous meteorites landed in the 1960s. It was called the Murchison meteorite, and it was very rich in carbon compounds. It was cracked open and then subject to an assay. What they found were amino acids, carbolic acids, various hydro compounds. They found very simple sugar-like material, amines, various heterocyclic compounds, where you've got these cyclic combinations of carbon with sulfur, with nitrogen. Very, very complex organic chemistry. But this is material which is coming from the raw materials out of which the planets were formed out in the asteroid belt. This is material which formed out in space, so it's about as far from biological processes as you can get. In fact, you get some very, very complex multi-chain carbon materials. Now, what you find is you find a mix of right-handed and left-handed amino acids. You don't just find left-handed amino acids. But there is a slight excess of left-handed amino acids in the Murchison meteor. You don't find all of the amino acids we find on Earth. You find a few of them. And the other thing is, if you look in detail at the isotopes of the carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen that make up the materials found in Murchison meteor, they have very different isotopic ratios than you find on Earth. So this was not simply this meteor hitting the ground and getting contaminated by Earth material. This is actually intrinsic to the meteor itself. You can crack it open to the parts that were not exposed on impact and find this material. It's one of the keys to recognizing extraterrestrial origin. In this case, just means elsewhere in the solar system is. It formed out of slightly different material, different isotopic ratios than formed at the region of the Earth. That's important. That's one of the signatures we use to recognize where things come from. You can get so good with isotopic ratios, in fact, in some cases, you can actually recognize certain volcanic flows versus other by location on the Earth, just by the differences of the isotopes belched up from that particular region. So it's a very powerful probe. So what this and the Miller-Urey experiment show is that getting from carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen to amino acids is not difficult. There are multiple energetically favorable pathways that do not require biological processes to get you to the raw amino acids. But having amino acids is not the same as having life. Okay? It's a necessary condition, but it is not sufficient. And what we can't answer, or what we don't have an answer by these experiments, is how those amino acids became part of ultimately living systems. Now, the other piece of life is you need a bag. Okay, so that's, we got some of the raw materials. We think the raw materials are actually readily available in the environment. There's various ways to make them. Now you've got to make a container. If we look at cell walls today, what we find is that cell walls are contained of these lipid bilayers. The lipid bilayers are very simple. They basically make bubbles. They have a water-loving part and these long tails which are water-hating. And so the molecules orient themselves very simply by simply taking the water-loving portions to the outside and the water-hating portions bond to the inside. And you get this bilayer where the hydrophilic, the water-loving parts, are on the inside and outside of the bubble. And of course, you make a very nice little bubble, a spherical bubble of these lipid membranes in water. They form spontaneously. It's energetically favorable to do so. There's another form of lipid membrane you're actually used to, in which you actually get a layer of water and the lipid hydrophilics are on the inside and the tails are on the outside, and inside and outside the membrane are air. Okay, so I get a thin layer of water. I think it'll be a little light there. I get a row of lipids on the outside. The little head tail here is the water loving part, so they bind there. The lipids, the water loving bits, bind on the inside. And then I end up with air and air on either side. That's a soap bubble. When you blow soap bubbles, you're basically taking a lipid compound and water and you're making a bubble out of it. You're forming a lipid bilayer. It's just reversed from the water bilayer water version that we have here. Here it's air water in the middle of a bilayer air. So it's just kind of a inside out soap bubble. Kill the lights there. So they form spontaneously, just like soap bubbles form spontaneously. You grow just in the same way a soap bubble grows. If you take two soap bubbles, move together, what happens? They often merge and coalesce into a single bigger bubble. So it's easy to form small ones, but the small ones can grow very rapidly into bigger ones. And so you very quickly grow these things up, and you can also split them. Although it's actually kind of a trick to do, if you make a really big soap bubble, you notice how sometimes they split into two soap bubbles by simply closing up, provided they don't do so in such a violent way that they break the membrane and pop. So soap bubble physics, which is, you know, pretty straightforward, we're all used to, is actually a big scale version of what can go on microscopically. I mean, this is small. These are 20 billionths of a meter to 100 millionths of a meter in size. But these things form all over the place. In fact, in certain chemical reactions with lipids, these little bubbles, these what they call vesicles, form all the time. So it turns out here's a very naturally occurring membrane. It's not living. It's just a lipid bilayer membrane. But if you look at cell membranes, the simplest cell membrane is a lipid bilayer but then it gets studded, or maybe it has skeletons of proteins show up over it later. But the basic structure is formed through very basic chemistry and physics. There's nothing really complex about the lipid bilayer. So nature knows how to make little lipid bags. Now, this isn't life yet, but it is a really perfect container if you're looking for a container to enclose the living machinery of life. And the machinery of life is reproduction and heredity and energy utilizing metabolism. So we know how to get the raw materials. We know how to get the amino acids. Nature seems to be able to make them pretty straightforwardly. They're actually pretty simple compounds, and they're energetically favorable to make. Making containers out of lipids also turns out to be something that happens fairly frequently in nature, using very simple compounds called lipids. Now, we know what the raw materials are. We got the containers, but that's not life yet, right? You've got to have something. It doesn't lead automatically to it. You need to put something in the bag that carries heredity, reproduction, and metabolism. So there's two different ways in which people have proposed that once you get the raw materials, how you make that leap from disassembled raw materials to things that begin to resemble proto-life. They may not be living yet, but they start having some of the chemical properties of life. There are two of these. One of these is called RNA world, in which you can form RNA abiotically, meaning form RNA without going through biological processes, and then you contain those RNA within a bag. Once you contain them within a bag, remember what RNA do is they help assemble amino acids into proteins. But if you do that assembly inside the bag, they stay in the bag. They stay within the vesicle. So this is one way you start. You start by building up the protein-building machinery. It's not living yet, but you also have machinery which carries the essence of reproducibility. We know that RNA can be replicated from each other. They are replicating molecules. The other model says that once you get, okay, the idea with RNA worlds, once you get these machinery, then the protein machinery gives you the metabolism machinery. The other model is called metabolism first. So this might be called RNA world, some it's called RNA first. Metabolism first says that, well, what you really need to set up is you need these catalytic chemical networks that process energy. We need to have something which is allowing you, you've got energy in the environment, energy in the form of either sunlight or energy in the form of inorganic oxidation. But until that energy is accessible, it's put into a catalytic reaction where you can access that energy without consuming the chemistry locally. You have to have a catalytic reaction that does not consume its functional parts. That gives you a way to then make that energy accessible to the protein machinery of a cell. So you have to have metabolism first, perhaps a catalytic reaction going on inside of one of these lipid vesicles, and that gives you the start. This is not living yet, but it's the precursor. It's a reasonable precursor. At present, there are a few ways to distinguish between these possibilities, and people are working on trying to understand which is the more favorable pathway. So we can't distinguish yet between which of these is probably favored in the actual natural world, but people are trying experiments to see if they can't get them going in the laboratory. So let's look at each of these in just a little bit of detail to see how people think they work. So let's start with RNA world. It proposes that RNA-based life arose first, that you don't start with DNA, you start with RNA. Viruses are a good example of this. This is one of the reasons why people have proposed this. Viruses, you'll remember, sort of sit on the boundary between living and non-living. Viruses contain only RNA. Occasionally there are viruses that contain little snippets of DNA, but they don't carry the primary heredity material. Okay, RNA has some very useful properties to us. We know it stores information, and that's a very simplified form of heredity. We know that it's capable of catalyzing its own replication because you only pair up certain molecules within the certain base pairs along the chain. We also know that RNA can act like an enzyme. An enzyme is a protein that acts as a catalyst in a chemical reaction. There are RNA-based enzyme-like things called ribozymes. You can see the combination of ribose and zyme like an enzyme, which actually are seen inside of living cells today that are part of the cell's chemical machinery. And there's some thinking that the ribozyme is, in fact, the much more primitive form of the functional catalyst within cells, and that enzymes came later once the ribozymes become the basic protein factories and you get more and more complex proteins, which can do the job better, take over. The problem of starting with RNA is, how do you make RNA before you have life? How do you do what's called prebiotic or abiotic RNA synthesis? Now, we know that nucleotides, the basic components, phosphates, sugars, the nucleotides, are going to be present in the primordial earth when there are phosphates around. We certainly see those pieces. The question is, how do you get those pieces to chain themselves together conveniently for you? It's actually hard to build up long polymers. One of the ideas is that the chemical reactions don't occur in the water where stuff is just bopping around. You often have a much better job catalyzing chemistry to produce polymers if you can do it on a surface, and then you dump the binding energy, which would normally break things apart, into the material substrate. What kind of materials are good at that? Well, it turns out that clays, simple water-bearing, very easily made materials, can act as substrates. We know, for example, that clays submerged in water often act as very good substrates for chemical reactions. People often make chemical clay substrates in the laboratory for certain types of organic and inorganic reactions. So what happens is, you basically can use, the idea is you could use something like clays, and people are doing these experiments in the laboratory, and showing that you can at least polymerize, you can form short chains. Polymerization is the formation of a chain molecule. But you can build these up in a relatively short chains, not super long chains, but little short chains, little snippets at least. So we're not going to go all the way to million base pair DNA doing this, but you can get little short functional groups. And these short functional groups, one hopes, can build up to the point that they make actual proteins. So there's an awful lot of statements of ifs here, and this is not just people sitting around thinking about this. They actually are doing experiments on various of these pieces to see how you can actually begin to start that process. You can make up a water solution with phosphates and the nucleotides, put them in the presence of clay solutions, and they are actually beginning to form things that look like short polymer chains that look like RNA. So there's experimental evidence that this pathway will work. The next piece is, once you make these free-floating strands of RNA, you've got to get them inside one of these lipid vesicles. Now, we know that lipid vesicles are relatively easy to make. We know that RNA may be relatively easy to make on a clay substrate. The problem is, how do you get the RNA in the bag? There's a couple of different ways to do that. For example, if it forms within a lipid vesicle and the vesicle forms around it, that can happen because the vesicles form starting out as sheets and then kind of fold upon themselves. If there's a bunch of this stuff bopping around in the liquid, sometimes that's going to trap them inside. If you do trap them inside, the question is, how do you then get, you sort of got a bag now with some RNA strands within it, how do you actually do this? How do you actually go from RNA strands to actual replication? Well, a couple of things can happen. Is one is that if you form a strand when it's cold, it's relatively stiff. It isn't wiggling around too much. You can actually get the two to come together and actually form a copy. And then you warm it up, and the strand will then unwind. And when it unwinds and comes apart. So one of the ideas is that you subject these to alternate cycles of warm and cold temperatures. When they're cold, they come together. The reactions are much better catalyzed when they're cold. You form a replication, then you warm up, and they come back apart again. So you've basically got a mechanism for replication, but it's very slow. Now, these vesicle bubbles, just like soap bubbles, can also split and fission. If one of these things has got RNA catalyzed copying going on with warm and cold cycles in water, then eventually you build up a bunch of stuff in the bag. And once you build up the stuff in the bag, you then split it. And now you get two bags with two different copies. Now, it's kind of not really reproduction, but it's kind of halfway to reproduction. So when the vesicles grow and split, they get to a maximum size and break apart. Each of them carries some fraction of whatever the contents were within them. And if the contents within were RNA, that gives you a very primitive form of RNA reproduction. It's not mitosis by any stretch of the imagination, but at least it's a form of replication. The bag provides you with a boundary to keep the products of RNA replication in the same place. If the RNA replication is just going out in the water, those pieces just go all over the place. So the idea of having a boundary to limit it is important. Once you build these protocells, they're still not living and they have a very primitive form of reproduction through RNA, then you actually can subject them to a form of natural selection. Certain of these are going to be energetically capable of working better than others. If you don't do anything, if you don't make copies of yourself very well, then you know when your vesicle splits, not much is happening. But if you're one of those that is energetically capable of making copies of yourself, then when that vesicle splits off, you have two copies. You then continue making copies of yourself, that vesicle splits, and so forth. You actually get something working, right? Natural selection has to work on something that actually carries out information over time. So the idea is that you end up with eventually building up fairly large strands of RNA. These RNA strands eventually fold in on themselves, and you get to the point where you get ribozymes. Ribozymes help catalyze the replication and can also give you a very simple form of metabolism. Now you start adding the amino acids into the mix. The ribozymes can begin to help catalyze protein formation. We know that they do this in modern cells. So the first ribozyme that comes along capable of catalyzing protein formation all of a sudden is a huge deal, because protein folding into enzymes is way more efficient than ribozyme catalysis. So what happens is here, the evolutionary pressure, if you will, the selection pressure on the system is not some notion of fitness in the environment, but your ability to tap into energetically favorable mechanisms that are more and more efficient in the use of raw materials and energy. If you've got a chemical process which is more efficient at using the raw materials to build themselves up and can do so with less energy, then that's going to be more favorable than to a very energy-expensive, resource-intensive method of replication. So here's where simplicity and efficiency matters. And that becomes then a property that then evolution, if you will, natural selection, can act upon. Those things that can happen more simply in the environment will happen more often. It's sort of a very natural way of looking at it. And so what happens is you end up with these protocells having their cell functions being done by relatively inefficient ribozymes. The RNA carries the instructions, but then once you start making proteins, the proteins are so much more efficient, they take over. And those vesicles that have protein functions are much more likely to better utilize the limited resources in the environment. They're going to be more successful at making copies of themselves. So we're not there yet. The final step is to go from RNA to DNA. Okay, we know that proteins catalysis is necessary for the formation of DNA in cells. Therefore, once you build up to the point that you have protein metabolism going on, DNA is much more stable than RNA. It also has more efficient, and it's much more error-free in its replication than RNA is. And so once you begin to form DNA, a system which has DNA instead of RNA to carry the heredity information is just way better at it. It's less subject to mutation. It doesn't come apart. And so it becomes more stable. And so RNA basically falls back into a second place role. Once you have DNA and protein synthesis, RNA is no longer the primary mechanism of heredity, nor is it the primary form of metabolism. It takes a backseat to DNA and protein enzymes, and it becomes the subsidiary role of carrying out the instructions of the DNA. The roles reverse. And so the idea is that you switch from being an RNA world to the emergence of the first prokaryotes in what's referred to as DNA world. Well, that's a pretty coherent story. I can kind of say it without blushing, but a lot of the details still need to be worked out. And this is an area of tremendously active research into abiogenesis, is trying to understand if each of these steps, in fact, can work together. People are working on pieces of it, but the grand picture has not yet emerged. But the basic story I've told you is pretty close to a coherent story of how you go from raw materials to the things that resemble the first prokaryotes on Earth. It takes some time, but it can happen pretty fast in a geological sense. We're not talking about something happening where you mix stuff together and poof, there's fungus growing in the bottle within a day. This process took many hundreds of millions of years to play out on the early Earth. The other pathway that people have proposed is that you don't start with RNA and then end up with metabolism, and then metabolism powers the more complex chemistry you need to build up to enzymes, proteins, and DNA. They propose, in fact, that the metabolism begins first. We see throughout nature, in non-biological systems, there are lots of catalytic chemical chains that can go on in the presence of organic compounds. The question is whether you can make those things and put them inside of a bag. And so they called this picture metabolism first. It says that these catalytic networks are the actual precursors to life, because then you have a bag with a battery, a chemical battery, and it's that battery that powers the more complex organic chemistry to build first RNA, then DNA. So the idea is that the problem is that RNA is a pretty complex molecule. It's really tough to form it abiotically. You've got to play these games with clays, they're more promising. But back in the day when people didn't have any idea of how you would build an RNA in the liquid phase, before all the clay catalyzed chemistry stuff came along, people thought that was an insurmountable problem. It's not as big a deal now, but it was. So the alternative is they said, well, we'll start with a catalytic reaction that processes carbon dioxide from the environment. So for example, you can imagine that you've got a carbon dioxide and you've got water, or hydrogen here in the form of water, H2O, or H2 coming out of some process. And you go through a simple reductive cycle. There's one, in fact, very common one uses called citric acid. Basically runs around in a cycle. You feed carbon dioxide and hydrogen into it, and what you get out the back is acetate, a very simple organic compound, and water. That's an example of a catalytic cycle. The trick is, what you do is you can say, well, how do I power such a thing? And the answer is, inside this cycle, it's oxidation of inorganics. That's much more likely. Sunlight is abundant, but it's really hard to utilize sunlight. It takes chlorophyll, which is a two-electron reaction, to do that, and it's pretty hard to do. So we start out with oxygen, oxidation of inorganics being the power source, a good ready source of electrons, and work them in some kind of reductive cycle that can take carbon dioxide and water and raw materials from the environment and make a catalytic reaction go. So this goes on in the liquid. Of course, if a catalytic reaction is going on in the liquid, it doesn't have any raw materials. After a while, sort of things come and go. But then you say, well, let's wrap one of these things in these lipid vesicles. Everyone loves the lipid vesicles. They're sort of the all-purpose bag of the abiotic world. So here's the idea. Basically, you get a catalytic lipid vesicle, contains all the various components. You get inorganics oxidation, for example, going on as an energy source within that bag. You couple the energy release to a so-called driver reaction, which is one of these nice little closed loops here, and then you get a net gain of material. Your catalytic network goes, you take raw material and you get product out, but you don't destroy your driver reaction in the process. Now, you basically have a bag, and it's slowly but surely churning out through this catalytic reaction little copies of the driver reaction and little copies of the product. The lipid vesicle grows, splits in half, carries half of the machinery, roughly half of the machinery to one half, the other half in the other, or it distributes them in some random way. And so you end up with two copies of a bag with a catalytic reaction bopping away in the presence of inorganic reaction. Now, there's no information here. There's no genome. There's no heredity. It's just bags of catalyst, little bags of chemistry doing their thing. So the big trick on this one is we can get the sort of a replication. We can get the catalytic chemistry and energy utilization. And then the problem with the model is, now how do you go to that, to building up RNA and proteins and DNA? So what you've got to pose it is, once you've got the catalytic machinery, you then are able to power complex chemistry, and it's powering that complex chemistry that can lead to RNA. One of the real problems of the metabolism first model is it hasn't been able to make that jump from catalytic reactions in a lipid vesicle bag to catalytic reactions that synthesize proteins and other stuff. So while the RNA world has a nice story that at least has plausible steps from primordial goo to proto-life, metabolism first still has the problem of making that jump to RNA and making that jump to things which can be the carriers and encoders of heredity. So it's a real challenge. But what people begin to imagine is, in fact, what may be going on is perhaps some hybrid of these, where you've got the RNA being built abiotically on clay surfaces, the metabolism in a bag becomes an aspect of that, and we don't have to wait for the RNA to build up ribozymes to build up some kind of energy control mechanism. It's pop energy generation mechanism. It's something that can probably happen in concert. It's very likely there are many pathways from non-life to life that occurred on the Earth. We are simply seeing the product of the one that was uniquely successful. Well, the final way that people have thought about this, I don't like very much, is basically to punt, okay, and say, yeah, we're not going to worry about how life started on the Earth abiotically. We'll say life began somewhere else. push the problem of abiogenesis under the rug and then just bring it here from the outside. Exogenesis says it arose somewhere else, was brought here by comets or asteroids. Maybe it started on Mars first. Meteor hits Mars, knocks a rock off. Rock carries proto-life from Mars to Earth. Mars then dries out and dies, but Earth, in fact, is much more likely, and life takes off. Well, that doesn't answer the question. That just moves it somewhere else. I don't like that answer, but it's worth talking about, at least in a second. Panspermia goes one step further and says, in fact, there are biological seeds of life running through all the universe, and, in fact, just happen to seed life on Earth during its formation. The seeds fall here, whether they fall on fertile ground or dead rocks, but if they fall on fertile ground, life goes on. That doesn't tell you, however, where the seeds came from. I don't like this idea much either. So people have talked about these. They don't have much support these days. Your book mentions them. You'll see them often. But it doesn't address the real problem of how life arises from non-life. That's a different question that has a lot of research behind it. We don't know the answers, but we're starting to close in. Questions? Okay. See you all tomorrow.